Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to go ahead and start. My name is Lee Sobel. I'm with the United States Environmental Protection Agency's Development, Community, Environment Division, which all of you probably informally know is the Smart Growth Program. Thank you for being here today. Recently, our office gave a grant to the Congress for New Urbanism regarding emergency response, fire response, and street safety. And in furtherance of that grant, we held an early workshop prior to CNU on Monday and Tuesday. So this session is essentially going to explain what we did at the workshop with both fire professionals as well as CNU members. And we are pretty much going to just take it away and jump right into it, and you can get a sense of where we found a lot of agreement and what issues we're still working on. And you'll get a better understanding of what CNU is doing with regard to the emergency response issue. So with that, I'm just going to jump in and introduce Eric Dumbaugh, who is going to take it away.
All right. Yeah, we had an excellent two-day workshop that preceded the conference, the Congress, and I'm going to sort of introduce the topic from the way we had initially approached it, and then hopefully provide a nice segue into what Carl's going to talk about in a minute. Now, with this group, I don't think there's a lot of need to explain why we like narrow streets, is there? No, I didn't think so. Right? Framing the street, good spaces, and the like. And this is St. Augustine, Florida, where what we're seeing is a street that both engineers and fire chiefs might have a problem with, but that works relatively well. What I do want to talk about, though, is the relationship between these issues, street size and safety. Now, this shows for 2002 fatal crashes in urban environments for different roadway classes. Now, the most dangerous roadway in terms of total fatalities are going to be your arterials, and that's not surprising because of the speed. But what is kind of surprising is that local roadways come second in terms of the total fatalities that occur on road classes in urban environments. And it's even worse if you look at exposure. If we account for the amount of travel that people actually do on these roadways, local roadways are far and away the most dangerous roadway class, with about 1.5 fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. Per mile traveled, they're more dangerous than arterials, they're more dangerous than interstates. And when we look at the types of crashes that occur here, they differ from other roadway types quite a bit. Now, multiple vehicle, perhaps unsurprisingly given the amount of driving we do, is hands down the most dangerous single crash type. But pedestrian and bicyclist fatalities, if you count them up together, equal the number of multiple vehicle fatalities occurring on these roadways. Now, nationally, pedestrian fatalities and bicyclist fatalities account for roughly 10% of the total fatalities that occur. On local roadways, they're fully a third. These are the users, and these are the environments where these users are most likely to be killed. Fully a third of the 3,300 fatalities that occurred in this environment were pedestrian and bicycle fatalities. And this also shouldn't be a surprise. This graphic's been floating around now for a few years. But what it shows is the relationship between vehicle speed and pedestrian crash severity. At 40 miles an hour, a pedestrian's chance of surviving the crash, forget about an injury, is only about 10%. But if you can drop those speeds down to roughly 20 miles per hour, their survival rate's almost 95%. Now, serious injuries will still occur, but a crash that a person survives is preferable to one that they don't. And this is actually quite generous. If you look at sensitive groups, children and the elderly, fatality rates are actually much higher at lower speeds. Some authors have estimated that the maximum survivable impact speed for a five-year-old is about 7 miles an hour. Speed's critical for ensuring folks survive a crash. Now, what probably has received less attention, though, is that if you get your speeds down, these pedestrian and bicyclist crashes are a lot less likely to occur. A study in Maine found that the probability of a fatal pedestrian crash occurring goes down directly with speed. If speeds go down, the likelihood that a pedestrian or bicyclist fatality will occur decreases. Also more interesting, though, is that the behavior of drivers changes at lower speeds. At 10 miles an hour or less, the number of motorists or the percentage of motorists yielding to pedestrians attempting to cross the street is 100%. Total yielding. It's not until you start getting above those speeds that you start seeing the auto-oriented character of the street taking over, and motorists cease to yield to pedestrians. And you can see speed and percent yielding on the table that's illustrated there. Low speeds, and this also receives perhaps less professional attention from my engineering colleagues than it should, low speeds are better for motorists too. And we know this, and this is well studied, we know this from traffic calming. At a minimum, traffic calming has been shown to reduce crashes involving multiple vehicles by 15%, and if you've got a high crash location, you'll see the percentage of crashes reduced upwards to 87%. Now, it depends on the type and the extent of the application, but there are clear benefits associated with lowering speeds for motorists. And it's for this reason that in the United States, or at least in Europe, traffic calming is not viewed as we view it as sort of a livability device to make our communities nicer. It's a traffic safety countermeasure. It's specifically included in the suite of strategies they use to reduce crashes and injuries associated with motor vehicle use. Now, why is speed so bad? Beyond the obvious physics associated with it, which is the higher the rate of impact, the more damage that occurs, speed's bad because it makes motorists less able to respond to hazards that are associated with the urban environment. Now, what this graphic shows, and this is straight out of the Astro Green Book, is the distance needed to stop by a motorist at different speeds. It's probably easier to illustrate with the graphic superimposed over land use. Now, this is Portland, Oregon, with its 200-foot blocks. Now, if a motorist is traveling 20 miles an hour, they can, upon perceiving a hazard and hitting the brakes, they can stop in about 100 feet, which is about what you would want. Within this framework, is there a laser light?
It's up there. It was.
Yeah, I can survive without it. They can stop by mid-block, and that's Pioneer Square. They can stop by mid-block, not a problem. But at higher speeds, the problem becomes more complicated. At 40 miles per hour, they get partway into the next block, a full 300 feet before they can actually bring that vehicle to a stop. And then finally, assuming 60 mile per hour travel, you can see the distance. They're not just going through one block, they're not just going through the second, but they're partway into the third. And that means in order to respond to any hazard in this environment, the braking behavior has to stop either way back or the travel has to be at lower speeds. Now, what reasonable people do in these environments, particularly if we design them for this, is that they just travel at lower speeds. But what this is intended to illustrate is not that people are going 60 miles an hour in Portland, but to illustrate the amount of distance really traveled at different speeds. And it's for this reason that we like to keep those speeds low in urban environments, because the likelihood that somebody's going to cross the street at one of these intersections or along one of these blocks in an urban environment is pretty high. And we know that increasing local road widths results in increases in speed. This is from McCourt and others. Linear relationship between street width and the 85th percentile speed observed on the street. Interestingly, and Peter Swift showed this to us during our event that preceded this, building-to-building width actually proves to have a more profound influence on speed than just the street width itself. It's the buildings that really frame that space and give drivers the visual friction that encourages them to slow down. When you start increasing the spacing between buildings, vehicle speeds go up substantially. And what Peter also showed us was a study he had done that shows that it's not just speed that's influenced, speed we assume is a moderating factor in crash incidents, but also a direct relationship between travelway width and crash incidents. And in this case, the relationship is exponential. Slight increases in speed or in street width have a profound influence on the likelihood that a crash is going to occur on a local street. Europeans take a completely different tack in street design than we do here in the United States. This is out of the UK Manual for Streets. It was just published and adopted last year. And it shows their perspective on how streets should be designed in residential environments. All these graphics are straight out of the manual. Very, very tight streets, 5.5-meter travelway. That's about 16, 18 feet max, with parking on both sides. And that's 16, 18 feet clear, not total. And you can see this. And the reason they approach this is because they're very concerned about speeding in residential neighborhoods. They also do other things that, as a traffic engineer, kind of blew my mind. They reduce sight distances on streets down to about 40 to 60 feet. We would never do that in the United States. So the question then becomes, well, if we see all these safety benefits with narrow residential streets, why don't we build them in the U.S.? And the answer, of course, is the fire truck, right? Because these fire chiefs are inherently rotten people. You know, and they... they would rather let motorists run over children than be delayed a few seconds. So what we really need to do is we need to stick it to these guys on traffic safety, right? I mean, that's going to solve our problems. Well, if we learned anything over the last 2 days is that this approach, and a lot of times, and I've been guilty of it too, we urbanists sort of take this perspective, and it's the wrong perspective to take. Now, the reality, and this has been really a fantastic project so far, the reality is that fire professionals are often the first responders at a traffic event. They do a lot more than simply address fires. And being at a scene after a fatal crash has occurred, they understand this issue at a personal level, and it's a level that we sort of, as engineers or as urban designers, deal with in the abstract. They see the consequences of this. And one of the things we all agreed on after the two-day session was that life safety is a critical issue. It's not just fires, it's not just heart attacks, and it's not just traffic crashes. What we've got to do is we've got to come up with community designs that address all of these issues in a comprehensive manner. And the problem we've had to date isn't that any single profession is bad or is wrong. The problem is that we simply don't communicate well enough. We don't understand each other's concerns well enough to meaningfully address them in our practices. We go about the professional work that we do thinking that we've got the solutions without accounting for the important needs of other groups. And the solution to these problems is really partnerships and professional understanding. So what happens if we begin to understand each other's concerns? Well, what I'd like to do to hopefully segue into what Carl's going to do is show you a successful example of fire professionals, urban designers, and planners working together. This is Abacoa, Florida. I don't think anybody would complain about that right-of-way width. But the reason why they've been able to get rights-of-way like that is because the community has a comprehensive approach to design. It's not just narrow streets, it's a total network, with the key portion being this route right here. It's an emergency response route. Now, it's a relatively wide road, and you can see the cross-section here. It's 48 feet curb to curb. But they've been very clever with the design in order to address the speed that might be associated with that. First of all, they visually narrowed those parking lanes through special pavers, which visually reduces the right-of-way to about 38 feet. Now, they've also added bike lanes, which tightens up the vehicle travel way, shaves off an extra 8 feet off that right-of-way. But the upshot with that is those 4 feet on either side can be used either for vehicles to pull over to get out of the way of a fire truck or to a fire truck to negotiate around a vehicle if needed on an emergency event. But for normal operations, these lanes aren't used. They're actually a community amenity. They're a bike path. So the effective travelway, after all these have been shaved off, is about 20 feet, two 10-foot lanes. Now, we would all say, well, 10 feet's still too wide, right? People can tear it up at 10 feet. We can easily do 45, 50 miles an hour. Well, the solution to that was introducing curvature into the roadway, which reduces speeds. We see this time and time again. It's what we use when we apply chicanes, which are a traffic calming device. It's the same idea. Let's introduce that curvature into this roadway to provide friction that encourages drivers to slow down. I went out there and I looked at speeds. I didn't formally study them. It was more kind of ad hoc. But speeds on this road were about 20, 25. Now, for a collector route, that's pretty reasonable. But even this street, one that we might often object to, now they were very clever about their approach to the design of this street. Sure, they've got a fire hydrant, but that one fire hydrant on the corner isn't going to solve the problem at alone. That block depth is 400 feet. Your firefighter is going to need to get in there at a closer distance. Well, what we've got is a secondary route on the back that also has a fire hydrant, which provides a secondary fire access point. They can hit this block from both sides. But they've gone further than that. Oh, and speed, the speed issue we're concerned about, is resolved by T-intersections. There aren't long straight stretches of road that are going to allow you to pick up serious vehicle speed before you have to brake again. But when we look at this section of community as a whole, how they've really been able to achieve both safety and the emergency response needs is through hydrant placement. And you can see where it is there. It's a comprehensive placement that allows multiple points of attack in a fire event. Now, this design side, the speed side that we're so often so concerned about, is resolved by building that network in T-intersections. You're not going to pick up any substantive speed in this environment. The network won't allow it. So the question then becomes, well, who are the reckless mavericks that would live in this unconventional community? Well, I walked around the alleys back there, and I found some of them. And there we go. So what we've learned, I think, to encapsulate what at least I think I've learned over the session, was, yeah, there are barriers that exist. I mean, it's not we're going to walk in and we're all going to love each other and solve the problems right away. There are policy-level issues. There are some design-level issues that need to be discussed. But what we really found, I think, is that these issues are resolvable. The problems we've had to date are largely the result of the fact that we simply don't communicate across professions. Once we begin to understand the concerns of other professions and start treating them as important concerns of our own, we can begin to come up with designs that resolve these problems. Partnerships and understanding are the solution. I mean, I think, particularly at this conference, a lot of you folks are very clever designers, and I think it wouldn't be very hard to come up with solutions if we partnered early with the fire professionals to come up with solutions that serve all purposes of life safety, fire response, emergency response, and traffic safety as well. There are opportunities for win-win, and the real winners here are going to be the people who live in the communities we design. And with that segue, what I'd like to do, and he did a wonderful job at the session, I have no doubt you'll be as pleased as I was. I'd like to introduce Carl, who is going to try to give us a perspective on the fire approach to these sorts of issues. Oh, he works for the San Antonio Fire Department.
Whoa, hey, easy now, easy.
Sorry, Austin. You guys are merging into one big city anyway. We just need to stretch over 35.
I didn't know that he was going to talk like that. I wouldn't let him go first for your life. Oh, my. Pardon me, just a second.
I'll just say while Carl's setting up, we'll take questions at the end for Eric and for Richard. However, Carl actually does have to get back to work saving the city and protecting it.
Actually, it's a personal thing.
Okay. So we will take questions, though, for Carl after his presentation because then he has to leave.
Actually, it is a personal thing. My two daughters go to another university in Texas. It's almost as big as the one here, and from my perspective, a lot nicer. It has a really nice ring. And and my youngest daughter is getting her senior ring at Texas A&M this afternoon, and I just really would like to be there since mine is 30 years old and hers is going to be brand new. Anyway, welcome to Austin. We like it here. It's a nice city. We have a wonderful staff. I've seen a few of them in here. I think I saw George, didn't I? Yeah. We don't always get along, and we don't always agree on things. And what you could tell from Eric's position is that we really had not communicated well. I will tell you that the fire service and firefighters in general do not want to see anybody hurt, in particular children. Most firefighters I know are big children anyway, and probably the most devastating injury call that a firefighter can get is to a child, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But having said that, I want you to understand that when they come to talk to you, there are some things in their minds that they really have a hard time getting out. And they just can't ignore them. And I would propose to you that bringing the information, the kind of information that Eric showed a little bit ago about injury rates, would help to give the fire service in general. And replicating that study and substantiating its results would go a long way in selling the need to have a more holistic view of safety in the community. And let me encourage you to see if we can't, as a group or as a multidisciplinary group, do that. So let's talk a little bit. Why are response time, things that cause difficulty with response time, a problem? I'm going to talk specifically about that in a minute. And what about turning radiuses? Why do we need such wide turning radiuses? And why can't we just get new vehicles? There's a couple of good things to say about that. One of the big issues that affects response time and responses in the city is phase development, because the second and third and fourth phases don't always get built. We have to have room in the area to deploy equipment. That means ladders, that means hoses, that means air packs, and most large cities anyway, if you have a fire, a true fire, you're going to get a ladder company and at least two engines, probably three, a chief officer, a rescue unit, and an ambulance. And you can't do that on a 16-foot street if it's a big fire. It just doesn't work. So building size and complexity also have an impact there. The other thing is that the fire service is also, in most cities, involved in some way, shape, or form with EMS. And you really need to understand the relationship between clinical death and biological death, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a little bit. And finally, you need to you probably do not have any clue, unless you've had a fire in your home, just how fast fire grows. And I'm going to try to show you a little bit of that as well. The first thing I want to tell you is one thing we talked about in our meeting, in our workshop, is that we'd like to have this community much like they had pre-World War II. And I think it's a great idea. There's one thing you need to know, though. They don't build houses like grandma's anymore. They do not build houses with 2x6 rafter attics and 2x12 or 2x10 joist floors. They don't do that. The other thing you have to understand is your couch is not your grandma's couch. It doesn't have the same cotton batting. It doesn't have the same cotton cloth exterior. There's a lot of different things. For those of you that don't know it, cotton, wood, and I'm not talking about cotton with cotton seed oil, I'm talking about clean cotton, wood and other cellulosic materials give out about 8,000 BTUs per pound. That's about 22,600 or so kilojoules per kilogram. But polyurethane, which you're sitting on, even though it's only about this thick, you're sitting on polyurethane. Polyurethane has a heat output potential of 24,000 BTUs per pound. And that's about 67,000, almost 68,000 kilojoules per kilogram. So let's talk about what happens here. The fleet of the fire trucks that your city has, and I'm going to use this a little bit. In most cities, now this is probably not that wide, but in the city of Austin, that's almost exactly 8 feet. Side to side, surface to surface. With the outriggers out and down, that in the city of Austin is 17 feet minimum. And short jacking, most of our operators do not want to short jack. A lot of people say you can, and I've even heard fire service people say you can. But short jacking means that you can't bring that ladder down flat. And it also means you can't necessarily put its full load on the tip, no matter how far down you bring it. This is a street here in Austin. It's a private street, I think. I don't know if George knows where this is or not. It's out off of Mesa near Station 21. This is Engine 21 trying to get in. And you can see that this is, if you make it very narrow and the turns are very tight, you're really adding to the time. And time really is critical if it's a life-threatening situation. But once you get through, actually, it's not too bad. This is after you get past the entrance. But it's really, really difficult. And Engine 21 sent this to me on their own accord. I didn't ask for it. They were that upset about it. Another issue is deployment of equipment. These are 5-inch hoses. We can lay a line that will carry almost the same amount of water as a 6-inch water pipe, but you can't turn that in a foot and a half. As you can see, these hoses are very large, and the pressures, there are places in Austin, Texas, where we have 125 to 150 PSI in the street. And you really have a hard time. And we've actually talked to our utility that we don't want the water pressure reduced unless it's in excess of 175 PSI. But a 5-inch hose with 175 PSI is a hard piece of rubber, and it doesn't turn easily. One of the things about this particular slide, this is from Seagraves. This distance right here is about the same distance as the ladder. That's about 39 feet. It's 480 inches, roughly, 40 feet. That's about the length of the bedded ladder on the ladder company in Austin, Texas. This is a tiller, which was common and still in some use in older cities. Austin, Texas hadn't ever had a tiller. And most of the young cities I'm aware of have never really had tillers. In fact, most of the older cities don't use them for their typical ladder company anymore. And I'm not an architect, but I got to learn how to use SketchUp, and it's not a bad little tool. My daughter is an architecture student, and so I get to play with some of the things. But anyway, and this is free now, so that's a good thing. This distance is about 39 feet. That's about the length of a bedded ladder. That means a fully retracted ladder. And in a 50-foot right-of-way, you can see that for the fourth story, you can't really even put that ladder in a window at 90 degrees at a fourth story. Our ground ladders are typically 24 feet and 35 feet. 35 feet will just barely get you to the third floor with safety. You certainly can't make the attic of a third story, nor a fourth story with a ground ladder. So it really is critical if you have multi-story buildings. Now, neighborhoods with one and two family dwellings, one and two story, really, there's no real, most of the fire departments I've dealt with, there may be exceptions, but most of them would never raise the ladder. They'll send the ladder company to a fire, but it's predominantly for the tools on the ladder, not for the ladder. But if you have three stories or more, apartments, condos, retail offices, and there's a fire, you're going to probably raise the ladder. And as you can see, if you put, I'm not an artist like my daughter. So this is about the size of suburban, and in your community, a suburban might not be a typical vehicle, but in Austin, Texas, it can be a very common vehicle. And so if you had two suburbans on either side of a 28-foot street, there'd be no way to open the side panels of our ladder company nor to extend the outriggers. So you can see my point that this physically makes the laddering of a multi-story structure on narrow streets difficult. And this one was given to me, but this will show you that they actually can set the aerial and the outriggers on the curvature of the street, and they do. Another issue is collapse during construction. I couldn't find them, but I actually have pictures in New York City, the classic older city in the United States, where the apparatus was fighting the fire from the street and the building facade collapsed onto the ladder. And part of the problem with that is that they didn't have room to maneuver the ladder to the places they needed to put it. Not always a problem, but sometimes a problem. Again, facade collapse, parapets. We had a parapet collapse on a fire downtown Austin that went out into the drive lanes of 6th Street. If you went down to 6th Street one of the evenings, it was just to the left of Trinity and 6th, about two blocks. The brick from the top of the parapet literally made it to the center of 6th Street. Now that's a small building, and it was only a two-story parapet. And I know you probably don't like tilt wall if you really are not interested in sprawl, because that typically means shopping centers and big retail, big box, that kind of thing. But tilt wall can potentially collapse a complete 90-degree collapse, the full height of the wall across the street or across the right-of-way. In California, friends of mine, this is actually in Taiwan, but friends of mine in California are terrified about putting their apparatus between buildings, tall buildings in particular, without room because of the potential for collapse during earthquakes. And I'm going to just go past that so I don't run out in too much time. I have a lot of good friends in Florida, and some of y'all probably are from Florida, but wood frame structures can be compromised very quickly in wind, whether it's a tornado or a hurricane. And again, if you're one of the people that don't get sent home and evacuated in a hurricane is the fire department. And if there are collapses, you're not going to call anyone typically, but the fire department, maybe if there's a separate EMS department, this EMS, to do rescue after a collapse. And if there are people that are stranded because of the storm or flooding, you're going to get that same call. This is actually up near the University of Texas here in town. This is a podium-style building. Under the building code, you can build a one-story concrete podium, and under here you put either parking or retail or virtually anything. And then you start here and you build up, and it can be wood frame. One of the big differences between the United States and Europe is right there. The vast majority of vertical mixed-use buildings in the United States are being built lightweight wood frame on a one-story pedestal. And a building like that in Virginia caught fire a few years ago and took out three city blocks, as I recall. We had a fire marshal from Virginia here this week for our workshop, and he's promised to send me the videos of that. So It'll be in my road patrol one of these days. But at this point, this building is extraordinarily susceptible to fire because lightweight wood trusses have high surface area volume ratios, which make them efficient fuel. And once it starts burning, there is no sheetrock, and there is no sprinkler, and there's nothing. There's no plaster. There's nothing at this point. And this is a conflagration waiting to happen. This is actually a video from December 1996. And this fire, I didn't get to show this at the workshop because I had it on the wrong drive. But I hope I got it on the right drive this time. We'll find out in a minute. I've been known to make that mistake more than once, so it might have done it again. I hope not. This fire is an unsprinklered residence. It's a three-story apartment complex. And what I want you to pay attention to is where the walls fall. And it's pretty interesting.
What's the construction?
It's type 5, 1 hour. Wood frame, 1 hour construction. Where's my key here? Oh, there we go. Most of the cars on that street burned, by the way. Most all the cars. This is an unsprinkled apartment. You can't build this today. But they're out there in existence now. This is a very short segment, but this was a massive fire. And the only reason that people didn't die in it is because it was a day after doing the finals. And most all the guys had gone home. I'm not going to play this video. I started to. I play it for architects and engineers pretty much routinely. This fire killed 100 people in 3 minutes. You count it, 3 minutes. I've been up here almost 12. We could have killed them three times over, four times over in time-wise. The other thing that we talked about, and it's true, your fire department may not have the same capabilities as the city of Austin. The city of Austin has 7 engineers on staff. Most fire departments don't. The other thing that most fire departments don't have is a significant aerial apparatus fleet. And if you build multiple stories, that's a problem. But then again, if you're building your traditional neighborhood, it may not be a problem. And engines have a much shorter turning radius than ladders, and so if you know what your department's capable of doing and what their apparatus is doing, that's an issue. The other thing about apparatus is they're not cheap. An engine company costs about $500,000, and a truck company is somewhere between $600,000 and $800,000 a piece. In Austin, we have 45 stations and 15 trucks. That's 45 engines and 15 ladders. And if they've been purchased over a long time, you don't buy those every year. And so they have different capabilities, and some of their turning radiuses are different. We did hear from one department that was able to replace virtually their entire fleet in a very short time. They haven't offered that to us recently around here. I'm not sure if that's going to happen. The other thing that I want to caution you about is that narrow street standard, we have a TND standard here in Austin, and it was misapplied here. This area is in South Austin, just south of downtown, not far. When they first moved in, people were parking on the streets, and we couldn't even get ambulances around these corners, not even a standard ambulance around them, much less an engine or a truck. Now, I grant you, this is not a proper application of narrow streets, but it happens. So you have that one reason. This is the kind of thing that fire departments go, oh, no, it's narrow streets. Can't have that because and such, we couldn't get around the corners. It's a problem. That we need consistency in how we apply the standards. Interconnectivity, turning radius are very important. The other thing, and this is one that's just recent, and it's kind of interesting, but the street's been there a long time. This is Westridge Drive, and it's also just southwest of downtown. It was originally platted to go through here, but they replatted and split the right of way of these two lots. Well, that's 900 feet, and that's about 300 feet, and there is no turnaround. Now, I gave away the turnaround right here because 300 feet is not too terribly bad, because the guy's going to put residential sprinklers in his house to do away with that turnaround. And as I understand it, because this is, turnaround is associated with this lot and the building is going to be on this lot, we don't get this turnaround. So we have a 900-foot dead end because the interconnectivity never occurred. This is not a major deal necessarily in this lot because these are pretty wide streets. But think about that a minute. We have several. This is not the only place in town in Austin where we have streets that just end because the next subdivision couldn't get city approval because the neighborhoods fought the extension of roadways. So let's talk about life and death. Clinical death is when you stop breathing. May or may not have cardiac arrest at clinical death. But when you stop breathing, that means your body has stopped transmitting oxygen to the cells. And what you will find is that typically you're going to have some brain damage in as little as 4 minutes from the time. And again, I've been talking about 15 or so. You'd have died three times over if your heart had stopped when you walked in this room. And so you don't want that AED, automatic external defibrillator. You don't want that guy that's been trained or girl that's been trained in CPR to not show up in 4 minutes or five or six. At 6 minutes, you're really pushing the envelope. It's a problem. So, and again, what I'm telling you is that these are the kinds of things that are in the back of the minds of this fire marshal that you're dealing with. You know, if I can't get an ambulance and a truck company or ladder company in there, and they have a heart attack in that area, somebody's going to die. And that's true if they ever have a heart attack. And heart problems are the major killer in the United States, if you really, other than cancer. So what you need to understand is that after 10 minutes, it's virtually a done deal. You can just write it off, whoever's there. I've been to more CPR calls where the person that was there with the dying person didn't realize that CPR was necessary, and we got there and they were already dead and had been for more than 10 minutes at that point. And it's really disturbing. It's really hard when the family thinks that you can do something and you can't. So again, I'm just trying to give you an idea of where these people are coming from that you're sitting down and they're just so inflexible. Also on fire, human viability is affected by multiple things, but heat, smoke, carbon monoxide. And you affect those by your construction, by your contents, and by the oxygenation. And I don't have time to go over this, but I'd like to. This is about when the fire department knows that there's a fire. About 3 minutes. Austin Fire Department's got a 4.5 to 5 minute average response time, but it can be as upwards of 8 minutes. So they get the call, and response time can be up here. And at this point, we have flashover, which I want to show you. This is a dry Scotch pine Christmas tree. And it won't take long, just a few minutes, if I can find my cursor here. It's not playing with me. There it is. Whoop. No. Sorry about that. I can't find. There it is. My mistake. Operator error. Okay. This is a Scotch pine Christmas tree. It's done by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. It's very dry. Now, this one has not been watered in 2 weeks. Pay attention to the bunny. The bunny is short for this world. What you're seeing is a high surface area to volume ratio and a material that burns very readily. It's got a high turpentine content in its sap. But once you get the polyurethane burning, you're looking at 24,000 BTUs per pound versus 8,000, a third less if it was a cotton batted couch, which nobody has anymore. I dare you to go to a furniture store and buy a cotton batted couch. It's going to stop at about 47 seconds. You can't even get a smoke detector to go off in this smoke in 47 seconds. I'm going to show this one, and I may be my last one. I don't want to keep Richard from having some time. This is a couch in a standard living room. It's polyurethane foam. This one's going to take about 3 minutes, and I'm probably going to cut it off at that point and ask you if you have any questions. It's lit by an electric cigarette It's the same heat output as a cigarette, and then they turn off the power to the electric cigarette at that point as soon as they have open flaming. And this is going to take about 3.5 minutes. But in 3.5 minutes, you're going to see that this room is about where that other one was in 45 seconds, 46 seconds. And it's important for you to understand that when you talk to a fire marshal who's been a firefighter, and you tell them that you don't really care if they make their 4.5 minute response time, this is what they're thinking about. Because it's not just the person in the house. A person that's intimate with ignition is probably not going to survive anyway, to be really honest with you. So you don't want to be intimate with ignition in your house or any place else for that matter, unless it's sprinklered. And we do give a lot of credit for sprinklers. We give a lot of credit because they really, I'll tell you in a minute, when this fire would have been put out by sprinklers in about 30 seconds from now, about a minute and 30 seconds, the sprinklers would have operated, and it'd be over. It'd be wet, but it'd be over. We don't have those in our single-family residential developments in the state of Texas anyway. There are places, Ventura, California, Cobb County, Georgia, just outside of Phoenix. I can't think of the name of that. Anyway, there are several cities in the country that do require them, but the vast majority do not. And I'm going to let this one run all the way through, because I want you to see the outside, what happens at the door, because that can happen at windows. What happens at the door of this test can happen at windows once they break out. And then I may show one more video, but you can ask questions while these are going on. Does anybody have any questions?
You didn't give us a conclusion to the great SketchUp diagrams. You pulled it out to
30. I cut them off because I was running out. I knew I'd run out of time. If you have a 30-foot or 60-foot right-of-way, you can pretty much hit the third floor of the ladder, and you can ground ladder the first and second floors if you have a problem. But a 60-foot right-of-way is adequate. 30 feet from the center line is typical. Or if you have only parking on one side, then 30 feet from the other side of the street is adequate for getting a ladder down to the third floor. Well, I'd look at it with you. I, to be honest with you, I don't know all the answers. I flabbergasted the city billing official in Austin 20 years ago when I came here because I told him I didn't know all the answers, and most of the fire officials he had worked with did. I'd have to look at the drawings, but it might work. I don't propose to know all the answers. I'm just giving you some background. There's a gentleman back here, and then I'll come to you. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. Yeah, well, you've been reading my email.
And the conclusion I came to is that your best friend probably is a bulged out curve where it makes it impossible for people to wrongly parallel park.
If you put lay down curbs on that and let me drive over it, I agree with you. My only comment on the Miller development, if y'all have seen some of the pictures of that or been out there, my only comment 4 years ago when it was that the turns would be awfully difficult to make. There are other fire department people in Austin that don't agree with that. They have a problem with the narrow streets in and of themselves. But I agree with you. Turning radius is a big problem, and it really is. And there was yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
And I truly understand that when you have high density,
Well, that's true. Her question was, in areas where we don't have high density and tall development, do we really need a ladder company, and can we get different vehicles? Our engines carry a lot of things, too. The fire service in the United States and Canada typically do hazmat, flood mitigation, rescue, construction trench rescue. They do high-angle rescue. They do wilderness rescue. I told you hazmat. They do EMS calls when they are life-threatening. And so they carry EMS gear, they carry rescue gear, they carry trench rescue gear, digging equipment, they carry hazardous materials gear, that is absorbent materials, both pads and absorbent materials. And so and they also carry one air pack for every person on the engine, plus a spare bottle or two. There's a lot of equipment on that engine. And our engines pump 1,000 gallons a minute. We carry 1,000 gallons because we can pump that 1,000 gallons while someone brings us a hose. So, yes, ma'am, you're right. We can get smaller vehicles. Most of the time it's an engine, and they do have better turning radiuses, and we don't struggle with them quite so much in single-family residential developments. That's true. Yes, sir. No. Let me see if I can paraphrase the question. Do we look at where the fire stations are when we approve subdivisions, and do we require, disapprove them if they're farther than that? Actually, the Austin Fire Department was removed from the subdivision review process in 1987. And that's one reason that one subdivision I told you about got approved, because I didn't see it. So no, we don't. To answer your question, in Austin, we do not base approval on proximity to a fire station. Annexations are reviewed. If it's built, and if we did, you could go outside the city limits and build in the county. Annexations are looked at in light of station locations and response times for areas that were built up out of the city. But a specific subdivision review, no, we do not. In gated communities, well, we typically expect to add another minute, because we require, if you gate the community, we require a Knox key on the gate, and it's a really pretty. It's just a matter of turning the key on the entrance pad. It's pretty minimal. If we have to cut the lock, and we do allow chain and lock on gates, if we have to cut the lock, it can add a couple of minutes. The other thing I said, and I didn't get a hold of it to talk about it.
Did they call about a fire right north of Greenway on 60th Street?
These guys had no clue.
60th Street and Greenway? 60th Street north of Greenway. There's a huge fire. It looks like something just exploded.
Then I'll
you know what's burning? No, it's a house.
Way over, I'm sorry.
Channel 2, 21 Assignment, house fire, 60th Street and Greenway, just north, engine 31, engine 37. Engine 27, ladder 27, battalion 4.
Engine 31's on the scene of immediate side residency with the working fire. Engine 31's laying the line and going with engine app. Engine 31 will be commanded.
I could, but I don't have a way to do that here.
Ladder 27 on the scene.
Ladder 27.
Ladder 27.
Ladder 27,
copy. Late utility.
In fact, I'll stop it right after the first thing I want you to see. Right there. This is lightweight workplace construction under fire conditions. They weren't expecting it. Until the 60s, you didn't see much in the way, especially single-family residences, you didn't see lightweight trusses until the 60s.
On July.
Anyway, so when you go out to Miller or to... some of these newer subdivisions, and you look at the roofs, that's what they're made out of. Now, they don't have the tile on them, but they have truss construction, and the interstitial space between floors is truss typically. Thank you. Thank you.
Now we'll hear from Richard Milk with Community Development with San Antonio, and then we'll take questions from Richard and Eric.
I'm just going to close. I'm just closing this up. He says he doesn't need it. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, he's been welcome the whole time. Thanks for being here.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for your kind attention, and I really am appreciative of the CNU and the EPA. Let me be a part of this.
Hey, Carl.
Thank you. As you can see, we've seen and learned a tremendous amount over the past couple of days. I don't have any images of burning things, so I'm just going to talk for a few minutes. And one of the things that I thought was particularly interesting, we had fire chiefs in the workshop from all over the country. And all of them had adopted the International Fire Code and referenced it in their work. And but all of us, each of us, had different interpretations of it and different applications of it. And part of that is policy context in each place. And part of that is also what I think is procedural context. And what I want to talk about a little bit is our experience in San Antonio adopting the SMART code over the last 2 years and the procedural differences, and putting it out as a case study to initiate discussion of this topic. We did adopt the SMART code in December of 2007. We would not have been able to adopt it without addressing the concerns of our fire chiefs. And the only way we were able to address those concerns, specifically to the narrow streets issue, is by, first of all, getting the fire department to articulate their core dilemma. And you've already heard it because it's the same one that Austin has. And then finding a new procedural response, creating a new procedural context in reviewing a process that allowed and empowered fire department staff to come up with creative solutions. So the SMART code was brought to us as part of a charrette in 2006. With DPZ was doing the charrette for an area called City South, about 15 miles south of downtown San Antonio, a large rural area undergoing rapid transition, new Toyota factory, new A&M campus. And after the charrette, we got together, I think we had version 8.0 at the time, and got together a series of subcommittees from all the different reviewing agencies that were involved, not just the city, but the county, TxDOT, other folks, and sat down and spent some time, and we took our time, educating ourselves, asking questions, making edits, making tweaks. But by February 2007, we were able to ask everybody for a written approval of the draft code and receive it. And we did receive it from everyone except fire. And part of that was because the fire chief with whom we'd been working announced his retirement a few weeks before the end of the process. So we found ourselves in the position of having to start over again with a new set of fire chiefs, and we spent another set of months talking with them from February to October. And in some ways that was a blessing because we got to actually focus on the issues that were at the core of the firefighting dilemma. And that, as we started butting heads on the street assemblies and the thoroughfares and the narrow sections in there, we stepped back and said, look, there is actually a lot of common ground. And a lot of that common ground showed up during the workshop, too. We all agree that connectivity is a good thing. We all agree that a project with interconnected blocks, short blocks, high degree of connectivity is good, not just for walkability, but for emergency access. The problem was that, like in Austin, and as Chief described here, the similar situation in San Antonio was that connectivity is not a tool currently available to the fire department. We did not allow or invite the fire department to review subdivisions and master plans at an early stage of the process. By the time the review got to them, by the time the project got to them, the streets were in place. Most of the lots had already been sold. Some of them were already underway, definitely way into engineering. So they were caught between a rock and a hard place, and were given really only one tool to use, which was a reference to the 20-foot clear citation in the code, in the IFC. So that's all they used. If that's all you give them, that's all they're going to use. So we all agreed, I think, around that table that that was a bad situation. And the first thing we all agreed to was to bring fire department staff to the reviewing table much earlier in the process and have them review master plans, have them review things at a larger scale much earlier in the game. Sounds like a simple fix, and after 6 months it certainly was just a minor and first step. But it ended up opening a lot of options. It really was the difference between that Kinney Court Avenue that Chief Wren showed you, that where I don't think the problem is narrow streets, but lack of connectivity to the existing neighborhood, and the Abacoa that Eric Dumba showed us, that had a very comprehensive approach to emergency access and managed to interweave the narrow streets with the wider emergency access paths in a creative way that met everyone's needs. But you can't do that unless you have your folks at the table early in the game. It allows us to talk about 20-foot clear, not on every street, but at selected and strategic places. It allows us to talk about hydrant placement in a strategic way, to talk about bike lanes and their use as emergency and access routes and transit lanes as well. But you can't do that unless you have them at the table early. We are so far happy with our result. We have a project that's coming through the system of Verano, a large multi-use project just north of the Texas A&M campus. They are proposing streets that have narrower, clearer than 20 feet, and they are working out fine, so we were able to look at the context and able to make some critical assessments of how will emergency access work. They're able to discuss what are within this transect zone, what kind of buildings are going to be allowed, what kind of other infrastructure and construction is going to be allowed. Details are going to vary from city to city as far as process, but I think our experience in San Antonio speaks to some general ideas, specifically that if we want fire departments across the country to respond in a nuanced way to the range of urban conditions that we are proposing, but that emphasize walkable neighborhoods, we can help. We can provide them the tools to do so, and I'll just mention a couple that came up during the workshop, and I think there are more to come over the next year or two. But one of them is establishing national provisions. We already have a model code, in a way, national provisions in the IFC. One of the chiefs at the workshop came up with a term that I think we all liked, which was a walkable neighborhood life safety code that would integrate the fire and traffic issues that Eric brought up early in his presentation. And finally, I think we could also help by emphasizing the procedural issues, by emphasizing the importance of bringing the fire and emergency access discussion, broadly speaking, to the table earlier so that we can address connectivity and make connectivity a life safety issue on par or even greater than any of the other elements that are currently in the IFC. Thank you.
We have about 12 minutes for questions, and before we take questions from Eric or Richard, I'm just going to point out one reminder. If you're here for AIA continuing education credits, at the end of the session, you can sign up on the list right here by the projector. If you're here seeking AICP credits, you actually have to go down to the registration booth. They have a list. So with that, just get that out of the way. We can now take questions for the panel here.
Yeah.
I'm going to dare to ask two questions at once.
Now, you might cause me a mental overload.
Yeah.
Number one is alley attack. I completely commend the fire the chief for being here, at least not here. Any discussion about single family residential, 20 foot clear occurs both in the front and the rear of the structure. So, discussion about attacking from the alley instead of, or in the
In response to your first question, there was a little discussion about lanes, but not a lot. One of the problems is, and it's something that would have to come out in the review process, is developers often don't like to provide hydrants and the like in the back through the lanes for cost reasons. That said, of course, fire officials are happy to have that extra point of access. But if we're not providing the water hookup for them, we're not really able to count that as a benefit for fire purposes. So, again, it comes into site plan review and how those things are addressed in that process. Now, actually, the vehicle design standards came up, and it was one of those interesting situations where we lucked out and we had somebody who actually got the fire vehicle manufacturers to redesign a vehicle to his standards. And a lot of the fire folks, as it turned out, didn't know that they could do that. And the discussion on that, I probably wouldn't be the expert on that because my knowledge of fire trucks is that they're kind of cool and I used to like them when I was a kid. But it's an interesting discussion and one that I think actually is going to be fruitful in the long term. The other that's related to that, though, that I should add is it's not just the fire vehicles that are used, but an interesting thing that came up are the tactics and strategies that are used. And in fact, one of the fire chiefs that was there suggested that there are a few environments that a firefighter actually couldn't access. But what you do is when you talk to them, you don't say, hey, can you do this? What you do is you find examples. You say, hey, in Portland, they're able to do it in this environment. In Milwaukee, they're able to do it in this environment. Are you telling me that your firefighters aren't man enough to do it here? And this was straight out of a fire chief. This wasn't my suggestion. And then the discussion, and it's one that I think with this project we ought to pursue in greater detail, is there are tactics and strategies that are appropriate in different environments, and they go along with the vehicles that are used. But collectively, these folks are pretty resourceful. And getting their input on how to address issues in different environments is going to be critical as we go on. The main difference, actually, is construction. They use principally masonry construction, and the fire folks that we were with unanimously agreed. If you want to do that and you want to use masonry construction, and if you want to supplement that with sprinklers, I mean, their perspective is knock yourself out. The building standards are higher in those environments in European countries, and that's part of the reason why they're able to do it. They also use smaller vehicles as well. I mean, the entire environmental context, the construction environment, is completely different than in the United States, and it results in different designs, which is kind of what I showed.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah, please.
I'm Patrick Sigmund from Nelson Nygaard Consulting. I did a fair amount of the work to organize the workshop, and I just want to add a couple specifics to what Eric said, which was quite right. When it comes to equipment, ask Pierce Manufacturing Company about the Milwaukee fire engine that they've designed, which has a much tighter turning radius. It was spec'd for Milwaukee in part because Neil Lipsky, the former deputy chief, specified something that would work well for his city, which already has so many hundred miles of skinny streets. There's a huge difference between adding one more neighborhood of skinny streets to a city like Milwaukee that has them already and fights fires on them already, and putting the first neighborhood of skinny streets into a city like Austin. So recognize that difference. With aerials, look at the Metz aerial trucks. For example, their stabilizer spread ranges from 8.5 feet to 14.5 feet, whereas on some of the manufacturers like American LaFrance and Pierce, you're talking 19-foot stabilizer spread. So you have to know what equipment your fire department either has or can purchase.
Yeah.
So what's next steps in this process? Is this an ongoing something moving towards something like the IED CSS manual? Or?
Well, Lee, maybe you want to take that as project manager?
Actually, Heather Smith at TNU is the project manager, and she'd actually be an excellent resource to talk about for next steps. But the idea of this first step, and actually just a little background, is about 5 years ago our office gave a grant to LGC, the Local Government Commission, and Dan Burden's walkable group. And they created essentially a Skinny Streets kind of 101 series of publications, introducing the idea of skinny streets and addressing fire response to the picture. And that's a very good 101. The idea behind this particular project is to take it to a next level, that being from the workshop to say, let's not give a 101 on fire or street design, but to maybe reframe that only in where we agree, and then talk about ideas of what we don't agree. So while I actually don't know what the end result will be, that's something that CNU will direct and massage to an end goal. I think basically we're looking for some type of an input in getting to either formal recognition and conclusion of what we agree on, or how to solve the problems we don't agree, or at least isolate and identify trouble areas. And learn that that's probably a third step and a final area to work on. And I'll let you, because that's Scott, you can talk in a minute. And I think ultimately now I forgot what I said, so Scott, go right ahead.
I'm Scott Paul from the Family Planning Group. I participated in the original scoping meeting in Chicago for this initiative. We talked about three or four things that I don't think have been determined yet. I think one concern was just an education process. That's probably insufficient. If it builds towards a recommended practice, then it also has to establish on a state-by-state basis what's needed in terms of state authorization for embedding the criteria into criteria or as it relates to building codes and fire codes, and also criteria for transportation design. The dilemma is how much can you do with one grant and move the ball forward. We all agree, however, if it doesn't lead to, at least directly but indirectly, the next step of it being embedded in some sort of state authorization that allows local governments to adopt with some meaningful cover of standards, then if there's no change relative to the state authorized fire codes, then really we haven't accomplished anything. So, Eric, you might want to comment further on that. I think the CNU and the EPA are still open to how best to spend the limited money, and it's, I think, $1 million grant. $1 million doesn't go very far when you're talking about trying to change the practice on a state-by-state basis in the United States. I mean, one of the challenges, for example, is the ITE recommended practice. It's still not an adopted criteria in your state, so you can wave it around and say, here it is, but if it's not an adopted criteria in a particular state, then it's not necessarily going to be used.
Right, and I just while you were talking, I remember at the end of the workshop, it was one or two fire officials who seemed to be the strongest advocate of doing a kind of top-down, changing the ICC code or amending. I don't know what the exact nomenclature was, but to change from the top the codes that go either to the state or local level, and then have it go that way. You know, obviously change it once or twice, and then have everybody copy it and replicate it. I don't know if you want to add to that at all.
No, I actually think that's a good summary. The only thing I actually would add, that just to follow up kind of the discussion on this, is that, I mean, I think the way for the urbanists to approach this from here on out, I mean, I think the real critical point of where we agree is connectivity. I mean, and it's not just that provides multiple access routes, but for deployment purposes, for example, those intersections, the fire folks love them. They can deploy in the intersection, and it solves the problem that Carl showed with the building falling down on the side. They can hit it from the corners, and if you can keep those blocks small, you can hit that fire from all four corners and get perfect coverage on a block. And that's really, I mean, I think if there's a point, the fire folks and us, we were all in agreement on this. And that made, I really think that's going to be the nugget on which we can really build this larger project. Now, what information specifically we need to support that? We're still discussing that. But there's consensus that there are policy-level changes that need to be made. But policy-level issues that we actually have much more agreement than I think most of us coming into the process thought we had.
Lee, if I can add one thing I forgot.
Yeah, please.
The outcomes of our initial scoping meeting in Chicago was that probably it's building on what Eric just said. You
problem when we got to some more of the workshop, is that the standard should be performance standard based in terms of access with all the issues, connectivity, deployment, mid-block issues, all of that, so that the local fire marshal can actually work with the urbanist to be more creative as opposed to trying to come up with a particular standard that meets every condition.
And I would just say, and Patrick, you can have the last word because I see your hand up. You know, it is still a working process, and everybody here at CNU is a CNU member now for attending. And if you know anything about CNU and how they work in other areas and topics and issues, it's very much collaborative and open. So if you're interested, if you have something to contribute, by all means, Heather Smith at CNU is the project manager for this emergency responder and Skinny Street grant. So please, by all means, don't think it's a closed system. If you have something to contribute, you know, by all means, you can participate. Patrick?
Yeah, I just want to add one thing, which is,
first, as Lee just said, we're going to need a lot of talented people contributing a lot of hours to this, and we welcome your help and input. But also, one book I want to recommend to you is called Planning for Street Connectivity. It's by Susan Handy. It's an American Planning Association report. And it has some of the most remarkable research on, first of all, the cities there that are requiring street connectivity. And second, the research that has already been done. In Raleigh, North Carolina, they did the research to show that when you have the fire station in the oldest part of town with the highly connected grid, it's able to serve three times as many properties within their acceptable response distance. Whereas in the new part of town, it serves three times as many properties as the fire station in the new part of town that's full of cul-de-sacs. So as firefighters are realizing this and starting to press for street connectivity around the country, they're often willing to say, if we get connectivity and can serve that many properties, we're willing to go for skinny streets. And that's the great alliance we can make here between new urbanists and firefighters.
We are out of time, and we'd like to thank all of you for coming today and participating. And these guys will be around if you have any other questions, including Patrick, if you'd like to talk to me. Thank you.